I want to continue in volume 3, beginning with December the 27th, 1899. And this is about love. Jesus continued to make himself seen like a shadow and a flash. While I was in a sea of bitterness, Louisa said, because of his absence, in one instant he made himself seen, telling me that charity. Now, when Jesus uses the word charity, unfortunately, our modern life has destroyed that word, and even evil people can be running charities. So we have to be careful that this is divine love. It's agape in Greek. Okay, and it's it's the greatest of the theological virtues. Charity must be like a mantle which must cover all of your actions in such a way that everything must shine with perfect love. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 14:1. You must want love more than anything else. I want to give you 1 John 4:7. God is love. I want to give you Colossians 3:14. And there is so much else in the New Testament about love. I've already given you many references. So Jesus says that love must cover absolutely everything we do. Otherwise, in his eyes, it has no value because God is love. What is the meaning of your being displeased when you do not suffer? He said to her. That means that your charity or your love is not perfect, because suffering for love of me and not suffering for love of me without your will is all the same. Now, what he's saying is suffering isn't the issue. Loving God is. And if you suffer for love of God when the will of God requires it, or when you are without suffering for the love of God when the will of God requires it, it is the will of God and love that matters. I've said to you before a number of times that the summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and love. Then he disappeared, Louisa said, leaving me more embittered than before, wanting to touch a key too delicate for me. That's her whole desire for suffering, which he himself had infused in me. Then after I shed bitter tears for my miserable state and over the absence of my adorable Jesus, he came back. And he told me, with just souls, I act with justice, or rather, I give them double recompense for their justice by favouring them with greater graces. And I would refer you there to the book of Daniel, chapter 13. I speak to them, he said, of just words and of holiness. So Louisa has offered herself as a victim to divine justice. So it might be good to remind yourself of this and write it down on the page. And so she is being dealt with according to justice because she has committed herself to divine justice. But divine justice is holy, is wise, is merciful, is loving, is everything, because it's God. So Louisa said, I found myself so confused and bad that I didn't dare to utter a single word. Rather, I continued to shed tears over my misery. And Jesus, wanting to infuse trust in me, placed his hand under my head in order to lift it, because it couldn't hold itself up. And he added, do not fear, I am the shield of those who are troubled. Okay, and he disappeared. So the Lord's shield or protection, I want to give you Genesis 15, 1. I want to give you Psalm 3, verse 3, and Psalm 5, verse 12, Psalm 28, verse 7, Psalm 33, verse 20, and so on. There are loads of examples. I am your shield. I am your encircling shield, the Lord said to Abraham in Genesis 15. So we come to December the 30th, 1899, where the subject is mortification, a subject we don't particularly like. Louisa said, this morning I saw my adorable Jesus for just a little. And since obedience had told me to pray for a certain person, when Jesus came, I commended her to him. And he said to me, humiliation must not only be accepted, but also loved. so much so that you would chew it like food. Now, most of us don't think in terms of humiliation as something you would choose or want or thank God for. But in actual fact, he's saying that we should accept it and love it and resign ourselves to it for the simple reason that humiliation helps us to get into that place of nothingness, which is the safest place on planet Earth. And just as he said, when a food is bitter, the more one chews it, the more one feels the bitterness. In the same way, humiliation, when it is well chewed, gives rise to mortification. In other words, you'll put the self aside, as you should. And these, that is, humiliation and mortification, are the two most powerful means in order to get out of certain hitches. In other words, sticky wickets that we get ourselves into. Jesus says humiliation and mortification is the way out to obtain those graces which are actually needed. So I want to give you Proverbs 18:12 and Proverbs 22:4. And I want to give you Psalm 113, verses 7 to 9. So Jesus continues, while it seems to be noxious to human nature, just like the bitter food which seems to do harm rather than good, so with humility and mortification, but it is not so. The more the piece of iron is beaten on the anvil, the more it sparkles with fire and is purged. And it is the same for the soul. So the humiliation and the mortification is the same as the fire on the iron. The more she is humiliated and beaten on the anvil of mortification, the more she sparkles with celestial fire and is purged. In other words, the huge internal, spiritual and mental and emotional and physical purity that is required for us to walk with God and be in union with him can only be acquired this way. So if she really wants to walk along the path of good, that's the way it goes. But if she's false, it's all the opposite. So I want to give you 1 Peter 5:5, Colossians 2:18 and Luke 18:14. So now I want to go to January the 1st, 1900, beginning the most evil and violent century in history, as Jesus himself tells us. And Louisa is considering the circumcision of Jesus. Being very afflicted because of the privation of my highest and only good, after much waiting and waiting, finally I saw him coming out from within my heart. You see, he's there all the time, but she's demanding to see him externally. He was crying and making me understand with his eyes that he was hurting from the wound received in the circumcision. So he cried and he expected me to dry the blood that was pouring from that wound. And don't forget, this is happening on a spiritual level. This isn't happening on an earthly, physical level. He expected me to dry the blood pouring from that wound and to sweeten the pain of the cut. I felt all compassion and also confusion together, so much so that I didn't dare do it. However, drawn by love, I don't know how I found a little cloth in my hand, and I tried as much as I could to dry the blood of baby Jesus. While doing this, I felt all full of sin because, you see, the creature is touching the Holy One. And I thought that I was the cause of the pain of Jesus. Oh, how sorry I felt for him. I felt absorbed in that bitterness, and the blessed little baby, sympathizing with my miserable state, told me, the more the soul humbles herself and knows herself, the closer she draws to the truth. And being in the truth, she tries to push herself along the path of virtues from which she sees herself far away. Now, let's go back a little bit. Why would Jesus ask her in this out-of-the-body experience to do the action that his mother would have done after the circumcision, which is to tend to the circumcision wound? You've got to remember that back in volume two, Jesus had asked Louisa to be another mother for him on the earth. And so this is an image of the church bleeding, and that in all of Louisa's prayers and intercessions and her sufferings, that she is in actual fact tending to the wounds of the church. And in the whole process, Louisa becomes more and more and more aware of her own sinfulness. Now, don't forget, this woman is at a very high degree of union with God. She's had three spiritual marriages that nobody else has ever had. But you see, it's the people who see God can see the desperate filthiness of human nature. The rest of us can't see anything because we're just so wrapped up in it and we've never seen God. So Jesus says, the more the soul humiliates herself and knows herself, that you truly know and acknowledge your own difficulties and problems, the closer she draws to the truth. Well, Jesus is the truth, John 14:6. And being in the truth, she tries to push herself along the virtues, and she sees herself pretty far from them. So that's Isaiah 43:19. And if she sees herself on the path of virtues, immediately she realises how much there is left for her to do, because virtues have no end, because they're infinite, just as I am. And so being in the truth, the soul always tries to perfect herself. There's a lovely passage in Philippians chapter 3 where Paul says, I haven't completed the race. I haven't reached the end, but I'm racing for the prize for which Christ Jesus captured me. In other words, I keep my head towards the destination, and that's all I'm looking at, and I'm putting all my energy into that. That's what Jesus is telling Louisa here. So being in the truth, the soul always tries to perfect herself, but she will never arrive at seeing herself perfect. Ephesians 6:4. 1 Corinthians 5:8. 2 Corinthians 4:2. And 2 Corinthians 6:7. I could give you more, but that's enough. And Jesus said, because she sees that she will never arrive at being perfect, this serves her, and it will make her work continuously, striving to perfect herself more without wasting time in idleness. Now, the people who think they're doing grand are sitting back doing nothing about going forward. And the problem is that in the spiritual life, you're either in reverse gear or you're moving forward. You're not actually sitting on a platform. And Jesus said, and when I'm pleased with this work, I keep retouching her little by little. That's Ephesians 2:10. We are God's work of art created in Christ Jesus. Philippians 1:6. Jesus says, the work I have begun in you, I will finish. Okay. And the whole idea is to produce the likeness of Jesus in us. That's Romans 8:29. We will be conformed to the image of the Son. So this is why I wanted to be circumcised, he said, to give an example of the highest humility, which rendered the very angels of heaven stunned. Because after all, Jesus was God. He wasn't just a man. So January the 3rd, 1900 is about peace. And I want to give you Luke 1:79. Luke 2:14, Jesus is the Prince of Peace. John 14:27. John 16:33. Ephesians 2:16, that where Paul tells us that Jesus is our peace. So Louisa says, I continue to see myself full of miseries. Not only so, but also I was restless. It seems to me that all of my interior had become alarmed at the loss of Jesus. I kept thinking to myself that my great sins had made me deserve that my adorable Jesus had left me. And therefore, I was not going to see him anymore. So there you have the lament of Psalm 63. O God, you are my God, for you I long, for you my soul is thirsting, and so on. What a cruel death this thought is for me, or rather more ruthless than death, no longer to see Jesus, no longer to hear the gentleness of his voice, to lose the one on whom my life depends. Now, she actually means that physically as well as spiritually, because she's living an unnatural life, sitting in a bed, doing nothing to keep her body alive and healthy. So Jesus has to sustain her life miraculously. And from whom every good comes. How can I live without him? Everything is over for me if I lose Jesus. Now, Louisa has reached that stage of Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10, that you love the Lord with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind and all your being. So if he's not there, as far as she's concerned, she's in hell. With these thoughts, I felt the agony of death, she said. All of my interior was upset, for I wanted Jesus. Psalm 42, I have nothing but tears for my bread night and day, as they say to me all day long, where is your God? And Jesus, in a flash of light, now God is light, that's 1 John 1, 5, manifested himself to my soul. And of course, John 8 as well. I forget the verse right now. And John 9, 3 to 5, I am the light of the world, Jesus said. So Jesus, in a flash of light, manifested himself to my soul, saying to me, peace, peace, do not want to disturb yourself. So that means don't put your will into it. God is concerned very much with what our wills agree to. You may be feeling a bit upset, but don't agree to it. Don't wallow in it. Don't disturb yourself. Don't let that happen. Take control. Just as the most fragrant flower perfumes the place in which it is put, so does my peace fill with God the soul who possesses it. That's Philippians 4, 7. The peace that passes all understanding and guards the heart and the mind in Christ Jesus. So Louisa said, Ah, Lord, how good you are to this sinner. And I also tell you in confidence how the word in my book says impertinent, which cannot be the translation because it's a very negative, offending word. She says, how demanding you are, for I must lose you no less. And you do not even want me to become disturbed or restless. And if I do it, you make me understand that I myself move away from you, because the peace I feel, because with peace I fill myself with God, while by becoming disturbed I fill myself with diabolical temptations. There is Louisa learning a hard lesson that the rest of us need to learn as well. If you allow disturbance inside of yourself and negativity, you're opening the door wide to the tempter to come in and wreak all kinds of havoc in your soul. If you close the door to all that disturbance and all that negativity and only allow the peace of God to reign in your heart, then the Lord can reign there, because he is a God of peace and he cannot come in the middle of a hurricane. And Louisa said, my Jesus, how much patience it takes with you. She's trying to learn how to respond to all of these challenges. Because whatever happens to me, I cannot even become upset or disturbed. And you see, she has been told that under no circumstances must she disobey. So she feels this tremendous pressure coming on her to obey in an area that she finds extremely difficult. So January the 5th, 1900, we're talking about sin and confession. Again, you see, this is only volume 3. We're dealing with fundamentals. Louisa said, as I was in my usual state, I felt I was going outside of myself in an out-of-the-body experience, and I found my adorable Jesus, but oh, how full of sins I saw myself in his presence. You see, the more we see God in his reality, in his essence, the more we see ourselves. And the less we see him, the less we see ourselves. And that's why people in an early stage can really think that they're doing well, when in actual fact they're full of filth. In my interior, Louisa said, I felt a strong desire to make my confession to our Lord. And so turning to him, I began to tell him my sins, and Jesus was listening to me. When I finished speaking, turning to me with a face full of sadness, he told me, "My daughter, sin is a poisonous and deadly embrace to the soul." Romans 7, verses 14 to 25. Now, deadly means mortal. It actually can kill. If the sin is grave, and not only to her, but also to all the virtues present in the soul, does it give this deadly embrace. That's why we call it mortal sin. If then the sin is venial, it is a wounding embrace, which renders the soul very weak and infirm, and together with her, the virtues that she had acquired, they also become weak and infirm. What a deadly weapon sin is. Sin alone can wound and give death to the soul. Romans 8, 31 to 39. Nothing else can harm her. Nothing else but sin alone renders her opprobrious and odious before me. Now, I translate that word for you, disgusting. So, there's an awful lot of scriptures dealing with sin, because the whole of scripture is dealing with the battle between the human will and the divine will. So I want to give you Psalm 78, verses 19 to 21 and verses 56 to 59. I want to give you John 3, 36. Romans 1, 18. In fact, the whole of chapter 1 of Romans. Psalm 5, 5. Proverbs 6, verses 16 to 19. Isaiah 3, verses 11 to 26. 2 Corinthians 5, 10. Revelation 20, 12. Now, while Jesus was saying this, I understood, Louisa said, the ugliness of sin, and I felt such pain that I cannot even express it. And Jesus, seeing me all contrite, raised his blessed hand and pronounced the words of the absolution. Then he added, "Just as sin wounds and gives death to the soul, so does the sacrament of confession give life. So does it heal the wounds and give back vigor to the virtues. And this more or less according to the dispositions of the soul. So does the virtue of the sacrament operate." So there we've been told that the sacrament operates at whatever level that we're open to it. In other words, if we've no intention of amending our lives, nothing's going to happen. Louisa said, "It seemed to me that my soul had received new life. I no longer felt the bother as before, and when Jesus gave me the absolution. May the Lord be always thanked and glorified." So January the 6th, 1900, after sin and confession, we need to restore our confidence in God. So that's the subject here. And we're told that confidence is the stairway to heaven. St. Thérèse of Lisieux said, "You will receive from God just what you have confidence for." If you've no confidence in him, you don't stimulate him to give you anything. But think of an ordinary family. If a child asks a parent for something but has no trust or in the love of the parent and has no confidence that it can receive it, it gives no stimulus whatsoever to the parent to actually give the thing. "This morning I received communion," Louisa said, "and I found myself together with Jesus, and the Queen Mother was there as well. Oh, marvel, I looked at the mother and I could see her heart transmuted into the baby Jesus. I looked at the son and I could see the mother in the heart of the baby. In the meantime, I remembered that today is the Epiphany. And in the example of the Holy Magi, I was to offer something to the baby Jesus, but I saw myself as having nothing to give him. So, in seeing my misery, the thought came to me of offering my body as mirror with all the sufferings of the 12 years in which I had been in bed, ready to suffer and to remain there as much longer as he pleased. That's a very important statement because she's always longing to go to heaven. As gold, I would offer him the pain I feel when he deprives me of his presence, which is the most painful and sorrowful thing for me. And as incense, I would offer him my poor prayers, united to those of our Queen Mother, so that they might be more pleasing to the baby Jesus. And so I made the offering with full confidence that the baby would accept everything. So I want to give you 1 Timothy 4:10. I want to give you Psalm 5:11, 17:7, 62:8, and 118, verse 8. Jesus seemed to accept my poor offerings, Louisa said. But that which he enjoyed the most was the confidence with which I offered them. Then he said to me, confidence has two arms. With one, it embraces my humanity. And it uses my humanity as a staircase in order to ascend to the divinity. Now, that's John chapter 1 from verse 51. Jesus said that he was the fulfillment of the vision of Jacob, where he saw a stairway to heaven with the angels of God ascending and descending. So first of all, use the humanity of Jesus as a staircase in order to ascend to his divinity. With the other one, it embraces the divinity and draws celestial graces in torrents. Now, I have Luke 11, verses 9 to 10 there, in such a way that the soul remains all inundated with the divine being. That means you have the humility and the confidence both together, enabling you to open up completely to what the Blessed Trinity wants to do. And so you become all inundated with the divine being. When the soul is confident, she is certain to obtain what she asks. I let my arms be bound. I let her do whatever she wants. I let her penetrate even into my heart. And I let her take by herself that which she has asked of me. So I want to give you Mark chapter 9, verse 24 and Matthew 21, 22. Everything is possible for one who believes. If I didn't do that, he said, I would feel myself in a state of violence. While he was saying this, many rivulets of liquor, and then in brackets, Louisa said, I call it liquor, but I can't really tell what it is, came out from the breast of the baby and of the mother, which inundated my soul completely. And then the Queen Mother disappeared. After this, together with the baby, I went out into the vault of the heavens. It's wonderful when you're an out-of-the-body experience. You can go anywhere. But of course, these out-of-the-body experiences are very important for Louisa because it's the balance to her being trapped in bed all the time. I saw that Jesus' gracious face was sad, and I said to myself, maybe he wants milk. This is why he's sad. So I said to him, do you want to suckle from me since your holy mother is not here? And before doing this, I became concerned that it might be the devil. In other words, she has to check out her discernment again. In order to be assured, I signed him several times with the cross, and I said to him, are you really Jesus of Nazareth? The Nazarene, the second person of the Most Holy Trinity, the son of the Virgin Mary, Mother of God, and the baby assured me that he was. Therefore, being assured, I placed him to suckle from myself. The baby seemed to revive, assuming a merry appearance, and I saw that he was suckling part of those rivulets with which he himself had inundated me. This is terribly important. We've nothing to give to God. We can only give back to him what he has given to us. And while he was doing this, I felt my heart being pulled out. Therefore, don't look at this in a very physical way. This is a spiritual experience. And heart means your whole person, your whole being. And it seemed that that milk which Jesus was drawing from me was coming from the heart. Who can say what passed between me and the baby Jesus? I've no tongue to be able to manifest it, no words to be able to describe it. But I want to give you John 14, 6, because Jesus is the source of life. And Colossians 1, 16 as well. Now, January the 8th, 1900, we're talking about Louisa's writings. I was thinking to myself, Louisa said, who knows how much nonsense, how many errors are contained in these writings that I write. At that moment, I felt I was losing consciousness. That means going into ecstasy. And blessed Jesus came and said to me, my daughter, errors too will do good. And this in order to make known that there's no artifice on your part and that you're not some doctor. That means a doctor of theology or scripture. Because if you were so, you yourself would realize where you were mistaken. This will also make shine more that it is I who speak to you. Now, this is only volume 3. And in the higher volumes, up in the volumes over volume 20, Jesus actually says that every single part of the message that is given in Louisa's writings is from himself. And it had to be from him. Louisa had no education. So it will also point out that it was I myself that spoke to you by looking at it in a simple way. However, I assure you that they will not find a shadow of vice or anything which is not virtue, because while you write, I myself guide your hand. That's extremely important. And another mystic still alive, Vasula Riden, also has that experience, that the Lord actually guides her hand. So I want to give you Deuteronomy 32, 15. The Lord alone was her guide. Having said this, Jesus disappeared, and after a few hours he came back. I was feeling all hesitant and concerned about the words he had spoken to me, and he added, my heritage is firmness and stability. Now, another word that he uses all the time is immutability. You cannot change God. You cannot change his word. You cannot change his laws. Nothing. They are immutable. They're, as we would say, carved in stone. And the problem with a society like ours that has moved away into immorality and into rebellion against God, they think they can change God's laws to suit the lower level that they're at. But you can't do that. God's law doesn't change. Nothing about God changes. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. My heritage, he says, is firmness and stability. And the more we walk with God, the more we absorb him and move with him, the more firm and stable we become as well. I am not subject to any change, he says. And the more the soul draws near me and advances on the path of holiness, the firmer and more stable she feels in doing good. The word here says, always says, operating. We say doing. And the further she remains away from me, the more she will be subject to changing and oscillating. Remember Jesus said about John the Baptist that he was not a reed blowing in the wind. Now, a reed blowing in the wind is someone oscillating and moving and, as people say nowadays, going with the flow. So January the 12th, 1900 is a very important section talking about knowledge of self. So finding myself in my usual state, Louisa said, my adorable Jesus came in a pitiful state. He had his hands bound tightly, his face covered with spit, and many people were slapping him horribly. And he remained quiet, placid, without making one movement. That's Isaiah 53:7. He did not emit even one lament, not even the batting of eyelashes, in order to show that he himself wanted to suffer these outrages. So I want to give you Hebrews 12:2, that for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. And I want to give you Mark 14:41. And this was not just the case externally. Louisa said, but also internally, because the great insight that one of the great insights that Jesus gave to Louisa was the revelation of the internal passion that nobody knew about. What a moving scene, such as to break the hardest hearts. How many things that face said, with that spit hanging dirtied with mud. I felt horrified. I trembled. I saw myself all full of pride before Jesus. I mean, to think that our God would suffer that for us would certainly horrify us. But while he was in that appearance, he said to me, "My daughter, only the little ones let themselves be handled as one wants." That's Matthew 18, verses 1 to 3, where Jesus said to the apostles that he wanted them to become like little children. And here he was showing the humility and simplicity of a child. Not those who are little of human reason, but those who are little yet filled with divine reason. Now, the littleness is the humility, and it is a divine wisdom that would make you respond like this. I alone can say that I am humble, because in man, that which is said to be humility should rather be called knowledge of self. In other words, we stop blowing our trumpets when we realise that this is what I'm like, and that's what I'm like, and this is what I do, and that's what I do. The one who does not know himself already walks in falsehood, Jesus said. Jesus remained silent for a few minutes, and I stayed there contemplating him. While I was doing this, I saw a hand carrying a light, which, searching in my interior in the most intimate hiding places, wanted to see whether the knowledge of myself, the love of humiliations, confusions and opprobriums were present in me. 2 Corinthians 6:3-10. That light found a void in my interior, and I saw it as well, which had to be filled with humiliations and confusions, according to the example of Jesus. In other words, she wasn't perfectly like him. Oh, how many things that light and that holy face which was before me made me understand. I said to myself, a God, humiliated and confused for love of me, and I, a sinner, without these insignia? A God, stable, firm in bearing so many insults to the point that he doesn't move not one bit to shake that disgusting spit off himself. His interior before God and his exterior before men were made manifest to me. And yet, if he wanted to free himself, he could have done it, because it is not the chains that bind him, but his firm will, which wants to save the human race at any cost. And what about me? Where are my humiliations? Where is the firmness and the constancy in doing good for love of Jesus and love of my neighbour? Ah, how different we are as victims, myself and Jesus, Louisa said. We're not similar at all. Now, it would do you good at this particular point to read the book of Sirach, or Ecclesiasticus, chapter 2. And it explains the mystery of humiliations. My son, if you desire to serve the Lord, prepare yourself for an ordeal, because gold is tested in the fire and chosen people tested in the furnace of humiliation. I'll let you read it. It's a most wonderful, wonderful, wonderful passage. So Louisa says, while my little brain was wandering in all of this, my adorable Jesus said, only my humanity, so that should be a capital M, was filled with opprobriums and humiliations to the point that they overflowed outside. This is why heaven and earth tremble before my virtues. And the souls who love me use my humanity as a staircase in order to ascend and to lap up a few little drops of my virtues. Now, the staircase is John 1:51 and Genesis 28, where Jacob saw the vision. Tell me now, Before my humility, Jesus says, where is yours? And of course, the answer is nowhere, Lord. I mean, by comparison with you, we're millions of miles away from the starting point. I alone can glory in possessing true humility, Jesus said. My divinity, united with my humanity, could operate prodigies at each step, each word, and each work. And yet, I voluntarily, you see, that's what he's saying. That his self-denial and his mortification and his humiliations and everything and his passion, it was voluntary. And that is the thing that he's trying to say to us, that, you know, where is our voluntary gift to the Lord? He says, I voluntarily constrained myself within the circle of my humanity, and I showed myself as the poorest, and I reached the point of mingling with sinners themselves. Okay. He was called a friend of sinners, wasn't he? You'll find that in Luke's gospel. And I give you Matthew 11:19 as well. I could have done the work of redemption in very little time. And even with one single word, in other words, he could have commanded it from heaven. But we would never have seen him as the love that he is. Yet during the whole course of many years, with many hardships and sufferings, I wanted to make the miseries of man my own. I wanted to exercise myself in many different actions so that man might be completely renewed and divinized, even in the lowest works. This is where Jesus made a divine version of each one of us, because he sanctified, he redeemed and sanctified every second of our lives from conception to death. And he suffered all our pains, all our difficulties, and he redeemed them. And he left us the grace and the strength to be able to operate and let him work with us. So he says he completely renewed and divinized even the lowest works for us. In fact, once they had been exercised by me, who was God and man, they received new splendor and remained with the mark of divine works. You see, he was able to elevate absolutely everything to a divine level, because being God, the divine will was nature to him. My divinity hidden within my humanity, just like the presence of Jesus is hidden inside of the bread and wine that's consecrated at Mass, wanted to lower itself to such baseness, subjecting itself to the course of human actions. Now, this is inconceivable to us. Because as human beings, we all want to be raised up and we want to be honoured, we want to be recognised, and we want to be loved and all the rest of it. So to have him lower himself from a divine level to the baseness that he actually did, subjecting himself to the course of human actions, while with one single act of my will, I could have created infinite worlds. You see, we have no idea how big God is. Feeling the miseries and the weaknesses of others as if it were his own. So there's no way we can say to the Lord, you don't understand. You don't understand our struggles. He does. Seeing itself covered with all the sins of men before divine justice, having to pay their penalty at the price of unheard of pains and with the shedding of all blood. Now that's Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 to 11, that his state was divine. He did not cling to his equality with God, but he became one of us, and as one of us, he was humbler still, accepting death, even death on a cross. Thus Jesus said, that he, in his humanity, exercised continuous acts of profound and heroic humility. Now, there is the model for us, profound and heroic humility. And you find that in the letter, Paul's letter to the Philippians, chapter 2, at the very beginning of it. I've just given you verses 6 to 11, so this is verses 1 to 5, in which Paul says that we have to have the same mind, the same way of thinking as Christ Jesus. And then Jesus continued, "Daughter, here is the immense difference between my humility and the humility of the rest of you, even that of all the saints." No matter how great their humility was, it was nothing by comparison with his. "Which is only a shadow," he said, "in the face of mine. Because the human creature is always a creature." In other words, completely limited and small and nothing. "And does not know as I know." In other words, cannot grasp or understand as I know how great is the weight of sin. That's our big problem, that today people don't even know that sin exists. They seem to think that sin has been abolished. And because of that, an enormous amount of sin is being committed. Therefore, the passion of Jesus is continuing in our society today. "Even though heroic souls following my example have offered themselves to suffer the pains of others, their pains are not different. They're not different from those of the other people. They're not new things for them because they're made of the same clay. So if I want to suffer your headache, it's the same headache that you have, the same value. Moreover, the mere thought that the pains are the cause of new gains for them and that they glorify God is an honour for them." That's your Hebrews 12 too. "Furthermore, the creature or the human soul is restricted within the circle in which God placed her, and she cannot go out of those limits. And she has, she can't go out of those limits which are prescribed by God. Oh, if it were in their power to do or undo things." This is very important, I think. And particularly to undo things, how many other things they would do. How often we would said, we've all said, "If only I had a chance to do that again, I would do it very differently." "Everyone would reach the stars," he said, "if they could all undo things. But my divinized humanity," now notice the way he's expressing it, "had no limits." Isn't that fantastic? "And yet it voluntarily constrained itself within itself. And this was the braiding of all my works with heroic humility." Wow. Isn't that something else? I think that this is a text that you have to just read over and over and over again. And what will happen is we might grow a little bit in humility ourselves and grow in love for Jesus. So Jesus continues, "This had been the cause of all evils which inundate the earth, this lack of humility." In other words, pride. And I need to give you Isaiah chapter 2 again, and it's verses 7, 9 and 11, that the pride of man must be brought low if anything's going to happen on the earth. "And by exercising this virtue, I was to draw all goods." Notice, by exercising this virtue, I was to draw all goods from divine justice. Aren't we being told something? That by being humble and little and throwing ourselves into our nothingness, that that's where the Lord will respond to us? "Ah, yes," he said, "no concessions of graces." come from my throne if not by means of humility. There it is, clear as daylight. Luke 1:51, he pulls the mighty from their thrones and raises the lowly. 1 Peter 5:5-9, and we have to bow before the throne of God. So let's say it again. Ah yes, no concessions of grace come from my throne if not by means of humility. Nor can any ticket be received by me if it does not carry the signature of humility. Oops. No prayer is listened to by my ears and moves my heart to compassion if it is not perfumed by the fragrance of humility. If the soul does not arrive at destroying that seed of honour, that self-esteem, and this can be destroyed by arriving at and loving to be despised, humiliated and confused, she will feel a braiding of thorns around her and she will feel a void in her heart, which will always bother her and will render her very dissimilar from my most holy humanity. If she does not arrive at loving humiliations, at the most she will be able to know herself a little bit, but will not shine before me, clothed with the garment of humility, beautiful and worthy of sympathy. Now, my dear friends, I can't comment on that. The only thing I can do is fall on my face before the Lord and adore and worship and ask him to transform me. I think it's absolutely incredible. But he's telling us, if your prayers are not being heard, look and see where the humility is. If your works have no value in his eyes, look and see where the humility is. If your relationships are not working out, look and see where the humility is. Louisa says, who can say how many things I understood about this virtue and the difference between knowledge of self and humility? I think that's the very important thing, because we think we're humble when we just know something about ourselves. I seem to touch with my own hand the distinction between these two virtues, but I have no words to explain myself. But in order to say something, I will use an image. She's going to try and talk about self-knowledge. For example, a poor man says he's poor and he honestly manifests his poverty also to people who do not know him and who may believe that he possesses something. One can say that he knows himself and he tells the truth. And because of this, he's loved more. He moves others to compassion for his miserable state and everybody helps him. That's what it is to know yourself. If then, feeling ashamed of manifesting his poverty, that poor man boasted of being rich, while everyone knows that he doesn't even have clothes to cover himself and that he's dying of starvation, what would happen then? Everyone despises him because he's lying. Nobody helps him, and he becomes an object of mockery and ridicule to anyone who knows him. And the miserable one, going from bad to worse, ends up dying. That is the way pride is before God and also before men. And here is how one who does not know himself already leaves the truth and slumps into the path of falsehood. So I want to give you Proverbs 8:13 and Proverbs 11:2 and Proverbs 16:18. I want to give you the book of Tobias, chapter 4, verse 13. And the book of Sirach, chapter 10, verses 7 and 12. Now, here is the difference with humility. Though it seems to me that knowledge of self and humility are sisters, born of the same womb, and one can never be humble if he doesn't know himself. For example, there is the rich man who, out of love of humiliation, stripping himself of his noble garments, covers himself with miserable rags. He lives unknown, manifesting to no one who he is. He mingles with the poorest. He lives with the poor as if he was one of them and makes scorns and confusions his delights. Here is the beautiful sister of the knowledge of self, which is humility. So I want to give you Luke 19, verses 1 to 10. So now we're going to get one of Louise's lovely lists. Humility draws grace is number one. Number two, humility breaks the strongest chains, which are sin. Number three, humility surmounts any wall of division between the soul and God, which brings her back to him. Number four, humility is a little plant, but always green and flowery, not subject to being gnawed by worms, nor will winds, hail and heat be able to do harm to it, nor make it wither even slightly. So number five, though being the littlest plant, humility produces very high branches, which penetrates even into heaven, braiding around the heart of the Lord. Now, Louisa loves the word braiding because she is a lace maker. And only the branches which come from this plant have free access to his adorable heart. So number six, humility is the anchor of peace during the storms of the sea waves of this life. Number seven, humility is the salt which spices all virtues and preserves the soul from the corruption of sin. Number eight, humility is the little grass which sprouts along the way, but treaded on by wayfarers. While being treaded, it disappears, but soon one can see it sprout again, more beautiful than before. So number nine, humility is like the gentle graft which renders a wild plant gentle. Number 10, humility is the sunset of guilt. Ooh, isn't that wonderful? Number 11, humility is the newborn of grace. Number 12, humility is like the moon which guides us in the darkness of the night of this life. Number 13, humility is like that shrewd merchant who knows well how to trade his riches and wastes not even one cent of the grace that is given to him. Number 14, humility is the key to the door of heaven. Wow. So there's one of your keys. Humility is the key to the door of heaven, such that no one can enter it into it if he does not keep this key in good custody. Finally, number 15. Otherwise, I would never end and I would be too long. Humility is the smile of God and of all heaven. And it is the crying of all hell. Because nobody gets into heaven without it. And nobody in hell has anything else but pride. Humility knows nothing about hell. And hell knows nothing about humility. So, OK, let's go on to January 17, 1900. So 1900 now, we have moved into the 20th century, which is the century of deception, the first horseman of the apocalypse. And in later volumes, Jesus tells us that, and also with other mystics, Jesus tells us that it was the most evil and violent of all centuries of human history. So for the evil and shrewdness of man, I want to give you Luke 16, verses 1 to 8. And I want to give you Matthew 23 and Revelation 6, verses 1 to 2, the first horseman of the apocalypse. This morning, my adorable Jesus was coming and going, but always in silence. So that means he's doing chastisements. Then I felt I was going outside of myself, and I felt Jesus behind me saying, "Man says there is no more rectitude, and as long as things are this way, we will not be able to obtain any success in our intents. So let us fake virtue. You see, it's the century of deception. The 20th century was the thing that gave us plastic, you know. I can wear this beautiful string of pearls around my neck, but they're not real. They're not real pearls. And unfortunately, those plastic virtues as well, pretense, horror. Let us fake virtue. Let us pretend we are upright. Let us show ourselves as true friends on the outside. For in this way, it will be easier to weave our nets and deceive others. Oh, dear. So I want to give you Matthew 23 for this. And when we come out to plunder them and harm them, since everyone believes that we are friends, we will easily have them in our hands without resistance. And Jesus said, look at where the shrewdness of man actually reaches. Now, January 1900, you have atheistic Marxism or Marxist atheism being spread out into the whole world, going to do absolutely horrendous damage. You have communism that pretended to be friends and pretended to do good, but in actual fact, it was utterly destructive. So Louisa said, after this, wanting a special act of reparation, Blessed Jesus seemed to cut my life off, offering me to divine justice. In the act in which he was doing this, I thought that Jesus would make me pass away from this life. And so I said to him, Lord, I don't want to come to heaven without your insignia. Now, this is the only time she ever stopped him from taking her. All other times she was saying, oh, great, I'm on my way. First crucify me and then take me. So he pierced my hands and feet through with nails. And while doing this, to my highest sorrow, he disappeared and I found myself inside of me. Okay. Oh, I'm still here, she said. How many times you have done this to me, my dear Jesus. I want to give you 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 to 10 for that. Indeed, you have a special art of being able to do it, and you make me believe that I must die, so I laugh at the world, at the pains, and I even laugh at you, because the time of our being separated is ended. That's why she'd laugh. And there will be no more intervals of separation. But as soon as the laughing begins, I found myself bound again with the shackles of the wall of this fragile body. Forgetting that I had begun to laugh, I continue with the crying, the moans and the sighs of my separation from you. Ah, Lord, hurry, for I feel compelled to come. She wants so badly to go to heaven. But she has 47 more years to go before she dies. This is martyrdom. So I want to leave it there for the moment.